writing what you ate for breakfast this morning, right? How can that possibly be relevant to anybody?
Is there an angle on Twitter that hasn't already been squeezed dry by the media? We'll give it a shot on this week's Radio Berkman. Folks, I'm recording this podcast from the park near my house. I came here to think about Twitter, which is the topic for today's podcast, whether Twitter really is a revolution in how we communicate with one another, or if it's just an easier way to find out what Ashton Kutcher had for breakfast. So today we're going to take a look at Twitter as a form of communication. We're going to ask you to take for granted that you know what Twitter is. I'm not going to re-explain that. It's a social network that asks people to say what's on their mind in 140 characters or less. So I guess I just did re-explain it. And we'll be using this half hour or so to explore what we hope is the question in your mind, because it's what's on our minds. Is Twitter really all it's cracked up to be? So there's an article in Ad Age from July that suggested that Twitter received so many mentions in the media, you know, TV, magazines, newspapers, that it would have cost $48 million for Twitter to hire a PR company to get that same kind of coverage. $48 million. It's hard to imagine any single communication platform, you know, like email, instant messaging, postcards, tin cans, and string receiving that kind of coverage, let alone a dinky little company that has yet to turn a profit. So what exactly is it about the way we communicate on Twitter that's so freaking unique? But I digress. You know, I came here to hear the birds, and hearing them makes me wonder if they Twitter the same way we Twitter. You know, it makes sense. Twitter has a bird for a mascot. Their name literally means to chatter, to utter a succession of small, tremulous sounds as a bird. Your average tweets seem pretty inconsequential. What a Twitter user ate for breakfast, what they saw on the bus, how they feel about the weather. These tweets are broadcast out to a community, a squawk in the wilderness, with no expectation of response. And birds Twitter incessantly, hundreds of times per day. Birds are probably Twittering about the same sorts of minutiae we Twitter about, in just about the same way, a squawk out into the wilderness. That's my theory, anyway. I was curious about this, so I tracked down on Twitter a woman who knows what she's tweeting about when it comes to birds. Her Twitter handle is BirdChick. She's also known as Sharon Steitler, a blogger, tweeter, and birder from the Twin Cities. I got her on the phone to ask if my humble theory, is there any similarity between how birds tweet and how humans tweet, is correct.
Well, there definitely is, especially when you get into some of the more social species. There are some birds that sing all day long, and when they're doing that during mating season, there's kind of two messages that they're sending out. One is, I'm a really cool guy, I have a really great territory, and if you're a female, you should come check me out because I'd be a really good mate. The other message that they're sending out is, if you're a male of my species, stay the heck away because I don't want you in my territory.
I have to say, I'm slightly disappointed to hear that in a way, because my thought was that birds might be, you know, just talking about random things, about like what they see. Oh, I see, you know, something on the street, or there's a person. But it sounds like they use it for really crucial, important purposes, whereas we as humans probably don't do that as much.
So, you know, actually, I think if you were going to compare it to anything, I think it'd be more closely related to bees. Bees do tons of communications, and when they come back to the beehives, the workers will do a dance to kind of show that, hey, over here I found this really great flower patch and you can get some pollen and honey here. And actually, when bees sting you, when a honeybee stings you, she releases a pheromone that says, hey guys, there's something bad over here. We should keep stinging it to make sure it doesn't get to the hive.
So we have that to blame. We'd have to get a hacker to get in there and infiltrate their communication systems so that we don't get stung when we go across their territory.
Or just a smoker to block the warning pheromone. You puff smoke on that and the other bees will leave you alone.
Well, maybe the corollary could come with the, you know, with the aspects of Twitter. I mean, there 90% of tweets probably are, you know, just people talking about what they're eating for breakfast or sharing pictures of someone's ugly hair that they saw. But that 10% of tweets, I mean, we saw with the case with the protests in Iran that people were using it for a pretty important, crucial, potentially life-saving purpose.
Well, you could get into the whole theory, too, of you have your mimic species, like your mockingbird, your brown thrasher, your lyrebird, your catbird, and those birds are just essentially retweeting. They're giving back songs that they've heard.
And what meaning would those songs have?
It's going to be the boring meaning again for you. It's the meaning of, hey, I'm a really cool guy. You should come mate with me. And if you're a male, you should stay the heck out of my territory.
So maybe what birds choose to communicate is more comparable to like something like MySpace, where you've got like a group of people just looking for sex and another group of people primping out their profiles and sticking their
Maybe. But I guess, you know, when you look at some of these social networking sites and how many people are using them to have sex, it's really not that much different from what birds are doing.
Well, it's interesting, the course of this conversation, we're trying to kind of reverse anthropomorphize, maybe, that when we tweet, we're doing something that is, you know, ingrained in us from, you know, the beginning of humankind.
Well, with tweeting, you know, you're getting followers, so you're kind of finding your pack and the pack that relates to you and people you can relate to. And then ultimately, if you take it down to the sex thing, you know, we want to find people who find us desirable, that we also find desirable, and then maybe we'll mate and maybe we'll pass on our genetics with our offspring. And that's essentially what you're doing with Twitter, is you're making your little packs. And then hopefully if there's a pack out there that you admire, like let's say you admire Will Wheaton, and one day not only does he respond to one of your at replies or he retweets something that you say, that kind of gives you validation that you're desirable and ooh, maybe even possibly have sex with him. I don't know. But I mean, I think there is definitely that aspect. I think that's what appeals about Twitter, is that you can follow celebrities you like and you have a very slim chance that they might respond to you in 140 characters or less. And wouldn't that just make your day?
So until we get birds actually on Twitter or on a social network, they will be restricted for the most part to their limited territory.
Yeah, but you know, I would think Twitter would appeal to them since it's only 140 characters and they're not really good at typing.
Okay, so maybe birds are less like human beings in how they tweet. And maybe humans on Twitter are more like birds. But Sharon and her own bird, Kabuki, that you heard in the background of that interview, brought up an interesting point. Often birds are having a real conversation when they tweet, and some bird species are even retweeting one another. Retweeting, pasting what another Twitter user says into your own profile, and replying to others' tweets, are the foundations of Twitter's social aspects. In fact, the very thing that makes Twitter a forum of conversation and not just a bunch of loud people shouting. Sure, conversations on Twitter can be great because they're inherently efficient. 140 characters keeps people concise and keeps them from expounding unnecessarily, but the nature of that conversation has created something of a nightmare for researchers who are trying to follow conversation clusters on Twitter, and for those who are part of the conversation, a stream filled with potential pitfalls, miscommunications, and inaccuracies, resulting in something like a digital game of telephone. Dana Boyd, a fellow at the Berkman Center and social media researcher at Microsoft Research, studies social networks and posted a paper for review on the retweeting phenomenon earlier this summer. I tracked her down to explain how these conversations work.
It's very hard to get a full sense of what is retweeted, even to follow a thread. The search API off of Twitter makes it very difficult to get the full content of it. And we also don't know why people are retweeting. But, you know, in the unscientific sample of people we've talked to, they retweet the things that delight them. Sometimes that's about news. It's really a sort of information, and they're really concerned about getting information out to their followers, meaning like news information, you know, like the Iranian election, you know, was front and center while we were doing this, right? So sometimes it's retweeting things that are really funny. Sometimes it's about links, so it's about, you know, getting people a sense of reference. And the question often comes down to, you know, why? What is the main goal of the process of retweeting? There's, you know, different motivations, but one of them, you know, is to pass it on to your followers, right? The realization that the people you follow are different than the people who your followers follow. People also retweet as a process of commenting, right? So they'll retweet a message, and then they'll add, you know, their own text to it, which is, you know, only messes with the ability to deal with the length of it, you know, greater. Of course, when you're retweeting somebody who retweeted that, you're removing the comments, right? You're removing the fact that they, you know, like Pepsi, not Coke. At the same time, you know, you may be adding your own, but who are you actually referencing in that process? You actually have to give some sort of context, right? If somebody just wrote Pepsi in response, everybody would be like, well, what is that talking to? Because there's also no direct pointer inside a tweet that even refers to what it's referring to. But we also have a genuine trick, nightmare with all of this, because a tweet is meant to stand on its own, right? And a tweet is meant to sort of make sense, you know, regardless of what context it ends up in. When you assume that everything is being read in a stream, not in context to you, not in context to, you know, the conversation or the thread, you have to assume that what's sitting above and below your tweet may have nothing to do with your tweet. So the question is, does your tweet make sense by itself?
It sounds like a trend like this could be perceived to be potentially destructive to the way we communicate as human beings, and the way we, I guess, the way our conversations are archived and later, you know, reexamined. You know, do you believe this to be like a big problem?
Well, no, because it would be a problem if the only way we communicated was through Twitter, but that's not the case. Twitter is one of many, you know, ways in which we communicate with different people. And there's something to be said about having the sort of peripheral information about the world at large. And what happens online is that it takes on a different form than we think of in physical spaces, right? So in physical spaces, we have all sorts of phatic rituals for communicating, right? Hi, how are you? Fine, right? Is any communication really shared there? Yes and no, right? The actual content of it is completely meaningless. Yet at the same time, it's a form of social grooming. It's a way of sort of reaching out, being like, I like you too, right? And it's this awareness. When we're in a physical space with people, we get to see all sorts of movement and body language that gives us a sense of what people are up to. We also understand through the space generally what people are up to. Well, online, you know, what does it mean to share space online? In some ways, we don't have this sort of, you know, lightweight peripheral awareness. And this is, of course, the set of content that's often mocked in the form of writing what you ate for breakfast this morning, right? How can that possibly be relevant to anybody? And the fact is, you know, I would love to get, you know, tweets from my mother to say what she ate, you know, for breakfast. Not because I care about the breakfast, but to just be a part of her life in this sort of lightweight way, right? Because if I was living with her, I would see what she ate for breakfast. Again, not because it's the most meaningful content, but because we're a part of a same space. And it's not a conversational media per se. Like, it's not about, let's have a deep, rich, thought-out conversation. This is a terrible media for that. But it is a brilliant place to, you know, have some level of peripheral awareness of the people around you.
You know, Twitter is this lightweight communications platform, and it doesn't have a defined purpose the way a lot of other online social communications tools do. I mean, the ones that are designed for a specific purpose often box people in.
Most of these things grew up organically. They were designed for totally unexpected purposes, mm-hmm. right? Like, look at social network sites. They were designed to be online dating systems, right? But that's not what evolved. And the blessing in all of this is that a lot of the, you know, social media has evolved with it. You know, the early incarnations of blogs were, you know, hand-coded, link blogs and personal diaries. And all of a sudden, tools came up around that to support already existing practices. So if you look at Twitter, it's not so much what it's designed for. In some ways, it was designed to be repurposed. And that's precisely what occurred. People repurposed it to meet the various needs that they had and to do the kinds of things they wanted to do. And the kinds of things that, you know, for the early users, they wanted to get back to a certain kind of lightweight blogging that used to occur. For the later users, it turned into a whole different set of, you know, opportunities.
Let me ask you a question as a researcher, because I've heard some researchers sort of disparage Twitter in that, there's a lot of written and archived content up there that isn't easily indexed or navigable, or and they encounter that same problem that you've been highlighting in your research of people, you know, referencing other things without a clear, you know, link back to the original post, stuff like that. It's just hard to navigate. Is that a challenge for researchers in your mind?
Well, I mean, it's a challenge for researchers because researchers are coming in as, you know, these, you know, all knowing, overlooking this, the environment, and thinking they can understand based on the traces, right? Well, what we're seeing is that no, people are not producing this content for all people across all space and all time. They're producing it for the audience paying attention to them right now, Right? They're paying it. They're very much producing the content for their group, their friends, and their followers. The challenge here is that we assume that we can actually turn all of that kind of content and make meaning into it, make meaning of it, right? Turn it into something that's sensible. Well, that's simply not true. I think we're seeing this because we're seeing, you know, all of this conversation, you know, big hefty, like, how do we monetize this, right? We monetize this by finding the meaning in all of this data. And the result of which is that most of the users are not thinking about monetization. Most of the users are thinking, how can I sort of, you know, interact with people that I know? You know, is it hard for researchers to come in and try to think we can analyze the data from on top? Sure. I can look at certain structural properties, and I can look at patterns of traced content, but I also need to get out there and interview people, right? Or, you know, I miss the big picture. I've never believed that you could understand things without asking people, like in any of this media. I think it's actually a really dangerous habit that some researchers have, which is just to assume that you can read into a MySpace profile or a blog what the intention behind it is. I had a very, very awkward encounter years ago when I was doing research on MySpace because Coca-Cola was super excited to find that their brand was being referred to by all of these teenagers. And I thought this was really interesting, like, you know, on MySpace, and I thought this was interesting. So I started to actually explore it and started to talk to some of the teenagers. And I realized really quickly it wasn't that Coke that was being referred to. And, you know, coming back to the Coca-Cola folks, I was like, guys, you may not want to be screaming this out loud because you're actually misinterpreting all of this content in ways that you probably don't even want to talk about. And, you know, we have all of that happening, which is that it's really easy to come in and misinterpret things. You walk up to a group of your friends, people you know really well, midway through a conversation, and you have no idea what's going on, right? So it's like, what are you guys talking about? Is a very common response to this situation. And yet somehow we think that when we're online, we treat it as though these are publishable texts, and that therefore if we just approach it online, we can obviously make sense of it. And this is true.
But the anthropologists of the future, like 200 years from now, I mean, if they come back digging through people's tweets like we do with Letters in the Attic, today, like, that context isn't necessarily there, but their job is to extract meaning from the content that today's generation is creating.
Well, and there's things we'll understand and things we won't, right? I mean, just like with the letters, it's not like we understand the entire lives, right? We try to build a portrait that gives a decent representation, but it's not necessarily everything. You know, with the content here, it's very different when you're consuming it as a whole thing versus when you're smack in the middle living it. Years ago when I was at the Media Lab, one of my colleagues there, Dana Spiegel, he was doing a bunch of looking at chat rooms, right? And he had people mark, you know, the threads of conversation, and he had them mark it whether they were in the conversation or whether they were looking at it as going back. And what they found was that someone who looks at a static reference of IRC, an IRC chat, cannot actually find the threads in the way that when you're in the middle of it, you can. Right? So even the same person who'd gone back, they were like, oh, wait, what is that referring to? How does that refer to? And you realize that there's something about the timing and the being in the now that gives you a sense of this, that even you with your own content step back, you know, a little bit, and you can't see the same picture. So no matter what we get as interpreters of content is never the same as what we get when we're sort of in the raw experiencing them. That doesn't mean that they can't have, you know, value and there's not explanatory purposes. But you have to understand that as researchers that we're not getting the same experiences as someone who's living and breathing this stuff.
What is one of the most interesting interactions you have had on Twitter?
Oh, dear. For me, on a more sort of personal level, I will never forget the tweet that I saw from my mother being like, would you call home? I was like, wait a minute, why is mom coming to Twitter to make me call home?
This is what you've brought me to, like, Dana.
Something changed, something's wrong here.
So maybe Twitter isn't really a forum for what we currently think of as quote-unquote conversations proper. But doesn't that make it even more significant as a communications tool? With over 45 million Twitter users spending a combined 4.75 million minutes per month on Twitter's website, Note that doesn't include the amount of time people spend tweeting from their phones or other applications. Perhaps the way we communicate on Twitter, in concise bursts, is changing us, changing the way we think, and is a revolution in the making. For the answer to that query, we convened a group of the best and the brightest at the Berkman Center, our summer interns, for an Oxford-style debate earlier this summer. The question, is Twitter a revolutionary force for social communication? The answers they came up with might surprise you.
Twitter is a revolutionary force for social communication, for it is the closest we've come to humanistic expression over the internet. Gone are the boxes that confine our tastes and the zones where we communicate our opinions. Consider the Twitter box not as a status updater, but as a mouth. A pair of lips that miraculously spout images and videos just as easily as they spit opinions, jokes, and songs. Mouth 2.0, if you will. Twitter understands the performance aspect of communication. We do not merely speak to communicate. We are not computers. We speak to be heard. To knock Twitter as trivial or lacking a utility is to say our mouths ought be portioned off and our reckless approach to communication should be systematic. I vehemently disagree with this assertion and ask this audience to consider man's simple yet complex nature as a cherished gift, and Twitter an enlightened attempt at digitizing this grace. Its only qualifier, the age-old advice we hear from all great orators, keep it brief.
That was Sawyer Jacobs for the pro side. On the con side, Andrew Mashurnia was less convinced that Twitter is revolutionary. To paraphrase the Bard, he suggested Twitter is all sound and fury, signifying nothing. A mouthpiece for media which only replicates the weakest parts of already existing communication methods.
We know that most Twitterers, in fact, do not tweet. They're merely passive listeners. So the speech contention that all the walls are gone and this is our new mouth is very interesting. Indeed, it is our new mouth that makes no sound. Twitter is a jack of all trades and a master of none. It allows you to do many things, each of which you could do much better using a different tool. Some people say I use Twitter to get information about new blog posts. Great, my RSS feed does that much better. I can use Twitter to find experts on a certain topic who can help me. Well, great, they're going to give you help with 140 characters. You could probably get a little better advice in a forum. So if Twitter's not trying to actually do anything new, and people aren't actually using Twitter, I fail to see how it can possibly be revolutionary, as it's not attempting anything new. And even if it were attempting something new, no one's actually using it.
Back on the pro side, Catherine White argued that, by definition, Twitter is revolutionary by changing the direction of our online friendships and conversations and by facilitating real-world revolutions.
A revolution is defined as a fundamental change in a power or organized structure that takes place in a relatively short period of time. So, has it been revolutionary? Well, it's certainly done a lot in a short period of time. Created in 2006, that's 3 years ago, it has, according to a survey done for Complete.com in February 2009, 55 million monthly visits from 6 million visitors and is the third most used social network. That's not too shabby for a three-year-old. Until Twitter, our online connections and friendships are very symmetrical in their nature. For example, Facebook. I friend you, you friend me. However, with Twitter, it turned that all on its head. And now it allows for asymmetric relationships. With Twitter, I can find people I'm interested in, whether or not they know me, and learn about their lives and thoughts. Others can include me in their lists. You can become friends with complete strangers by communicating with them or responding with the @messages symbol. It's also worked in many other ways with getting people aware of what's going on quickly and fast. In Moldova recently, there were protests about alleged corruption in the elections there. And many people protested about this, and it's been said that a lot of this was facilitated by Twitter. Now, Ethan Zuckerman's written on how much Twitter perhaps played in this or not, but it has been said that when the cell phone system went down and people couldn't send text, they were still able to tweet what was going on, getting news out rapidly. It's connecting people that otherwise wouldn't be connecting to the rest of the world.
Chris Peterson argued that Twitter is not only not breaking down the communication walls, it is in fact building them up, forcing users into one-way relationships with traditional communication oligarchs.
You cite the asymmetric nature of communication on Twitter as a revolution, and yet that seems strangely familiar to mainstream media, newspapers, talking heads, where very, very few people are followed by very many. If anything, Twitter is a counter-revolution. It's a conservative movement in our communication, away from symmetric communication, away from people talking to each other and a few people talking at each other. It's a power law distribution. 90% of Twitter users account for 10% of the tweets. 10% of Twitter users account for 90% of the tweets. 10% of Twitter users are followed by 90%, and that sort of normal old imbalance that we see all over the place.
If Twitter isn't in fact revolutionary, would that then mean that other presumably revolutionary methods of digital communication are equally insignificant? Audience questions provoked debaters into coming up with an effective analogy.
I have a question for the anti-Twitter side. You mentioned that 90% of Twitter accounts have kind of just been left dormant, and that's an indication of kind of how the service isn't being really used. It's kind of bringing us back to the old one-way mass media model. But recently, the New York Times did a study with Technorati, the blog aggregating service, showing that actually 95% of blogs have been abandoned. Would you say that blogging is also trivial?
Blogging introduced something new. Blogging, in fact, was a new thing. Before blogging, I mean, the idea of being of all information kind of being filtered through a webmaster, it's kind of a limiting thing. If you use Twitter as an RSS feed, if you use it as a blog, if you use it as a texting service, you're just using it as another existing technology. And the motion before us is it's a revolutionary force. You know, the fact that a hammer can be used for good or ill is fine. That's great. So whoever invented the hammer, wow, that was revolutionary. Whoever invented the hammer with a vulcanized rubber grip did not revolutionize the way we used hammers. They just made a streamlined hammer.
I just really quickly want to say, of course I agree that a rubberized grip did not revolutionize the hammer. But is it fair to maybe assume that the Swiss Army knife revolutionized the knife? In that it is not necessarily the best knife. It doesn't cut everything. But it's also a knife that can open a beer. It's a knife that can open a bottle of wine. And it's a knife that could poke a hole in my belt. Twitter serves a purpose in that if I wanted to aggregate myself, my identity, all of my internet ethos, I would go to Twitter to do that.
And what about Twitter as a voice to power? Could Twitter be revolutionary as a way of making change in the real world?
Companies are forced to listen to people now when there's a gripe because they know on Twitter, if they're upset at AT&T about something like there has been recently, it's going up there, and they have to listen. And on my own, writing a letter to AT&T, well, many people would have to do that. It wouldn't be so fast. But it's revolutionary in getting voices heard together quickly.
Collective action existed before Twitter. Collective action has existed online in many different services. There have been, I don't think we should just imagine that 3 years ago we all sat around helpless and there was never an online petition or blog movement. I would point to Consumerist for that.
As the debate progressed, the pro and con got back to the question of what, in fact, does the word revolutionary mean? And does it apply in this case?
I think, unfortunately, if we're talking about something being revolutionary, we do have to talk about what comes before it. Because if you had no idea of any of the tools that came before the car, and all of a sudden you said, oh, well, this brand of car is revolutionary, and you'd say, well, you know, unfortunately, we've had cars for 50 years. This one doesn't do anything new. It's actually not revolutionary. So I think to answer the question about if something's revolutionary, we do have to look at what came before it.
I guess if you want to compare blogs to the car, it would only be fair to compare Twitter to the motorcycle. And when the plane crashed in the Hudson River, it took a motorcycle to very quickly respond and take pictures and post to the community that something has happened. A blog would not have really been a worthy adversary to go about doing something like that. You're not going to sit out on the wing of a plane and think up a couple paragraphs on why it's so gosh darn cold out there. You're just going to write, I'm on the wing of a plane. Somebody get over here and get me off the wing of this plane. Through being able to microtize, sorry, I'm at Harvard, I just said microtize, but through being able to say, to, you know, condense the blog has given it a revolutionary aspect for this mobile internet era we live in.
So what do you think? Is Twitter all it's cracked up to be, or is it just a fad, a pet rock for the early 21st century? Share your thoughts on the blog, where you can find the full uncut intern Twitter debate, and also find out who won, at blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman. If you're already subscribed to our podcast, you've already got the full debate. It's greater than 140 characters, but well worth the time. So that's about all the time we have for this week's show. We've had a great season of Radio Berkman and have a bunch of surprises in store for the fall. Until then, a big, big thank you to intern Rebecca Heacock for organizing and moderating the Twitter debate and all our interns who participated. Thanks also to prolific tweeter Jillian York, who was interviewed, but we didn't have time to fit into this episode. This week's Radio Berkman was produced by me, Daniel Dennis Jones, a.k.a. Blanket, along with Catherine _ White, S.C. Jacobs, Rebecca Redux, PD05, along with
at Zephoria
and
Birdchick
from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University in Boston.